Our text this week is Psalm 27. This psalm is nestled in a section of psalms that focus a lot on dwelling with God. In Psalm 15 and 24, you have the requirements laid out for those who are able to dwell with God, or it says ascend his hill and dwell in his temple. You have Psalm 26 asking to be able to dwell with God. And here in Psalm 27, we see some of the privileges that come from knowing we will dwell with God forever as we face trials and adversity this side of heaven. So keep that in mind as we hear the word of the Lord. Psalm 27, verse 1. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and my foes, it is they who will stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war arise against me, yet I will be confident. One thing I have asked of the Lord, that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. And now my head shall be lifted above my enemies all around me. And I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud. Be gracious to me and answer me. You have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, I do seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger. O you who have been my help, cast me not off. Forsake me not, O God, of my salvation. For my father and mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. Give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and they breathe out violence. I believe that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, all eyes up here, right? This isn't just grown-up time, right? God loves all the kids here and wants all of you to know how much he loves you and what he's done for you. So I have a question to ask you. How many of you guys love to wait for something? Nobody loves it? I don't really like waiting a long time either, and I don't think many grown-ups like to wait. And when you want something, when do you want it? Right now, right? But a lot of times we have to wait. I remember one time, my little Emmy, when she was just a little girl, Miss Holly, her mom, said, oh, Emmy, you have to be patient. You have to wait. And Emmy said, but Mom, patient is hard. It is hard to wait and be patient. I don't know if you listened when I read the Bible today, but the Bible tells us here we're supposed to wait for the Lord. But it's hard. We always want to say, but I want it now. And it's okay to want good things, right? But a lot of times God makes us wait till he thinks it's the right time for us to have these things. And often that's not when we want it. But you know why God makes us wait for things? It helps us trust him. And do you know what God does? This is so awesome that God does this. He doesn't always give you what you want, but he always gives you what you need. That might be hard to understand sometimes, but things you need, you really have to have, right? God will give you those things, but sometimes he won't always give you what you want. And it's because he loves you, and he wants to give you what's most important. And that's when we have to say, okay, God, please help me wait and help me remember how much you love me. And sometimes it might seem that God doesn't love you if he's not giving you what you want. But don't listen to that. If that thought comes in your mind, don't listen to it, because that's a lie. God does love you because Jesus died for you, right? So you could be with him forever in heaven. That's how much he loves you. So next time you're finding it really hard to wait for something and your parents have told you, be patient, wait. Say, okay, God, help me be patient. Help me remember that you love me. And when I have to wait for something, it's because you're giving me what's best for me. Can you think about that? It'll be hard, but it's something God promises he'll help you do, okay? All right, thank you for listening. So, as I said, this psalm puts our focus on the fact that we will be able to dwell with God forever. And it's supposed to show us how we will face adversity. This psalm is a wonderful model for us on how to face adversity of any sort. And what we see here is that when David is faced with adversity, real adversity, this is not David turning drama, when it's a mild problem and him making it feel like it's a big deal. That is also something we struggle with. David's facing real adversity here. He's facing physical death. He's using military language here. And we don't know what portion of David's life this comes from, but pick one. David had enemies all his days who sought his life. And he's facing real, serious, life-threatening adversity. So our first point, where does he go? He runs right to God, not away. And what does he do? He runs to God and rehearses what God has promised, who God is. So our first point, when faced with adversity, you run to God and you rehearse his acts and who he is. But then what you see David do, after that has put his problems in perspective, he asks God for deliverance. It blows my mind how rarely we do this and how rarely I do it. So after rehearsing who God is and what he's done, he asks God for deliverance in the midst of his trials. And then what you see him do after that, the final point, he hopefully, not meaning he might do it, meaning full of hope, he waits on the Lord. So, first point, when faced with adversity, where do you go? I don't think it's knee-jerk for many of us to run to the Lord the way that we should. And again, in the midst of this, David first does not go, God, take this away. There's times when that's appropriate, okay? I mean, you're realizing you've just started sliding on ice and you're headed toward a precipice. It is fine to say, Lord, help, okay? But there's times when we don't rehearse who God is. We don't rehearse what he's done. We just cry out, but we cry out somewhat hopelessly because we've allowed what's in front of us to become gigantic and to eclipse God. And so, yes, we cry out, but it's almost kind of like, I know you're not gonna. And so when we are afforded the ability to do so, meaning you're not about to fall off a cliff, okay, start by rehearsing who God is and what he's done. And that's what David shows us here. So where does David start? The Lord is my light and my salvation. The Lord is the stronghold of my life. And then he asks, so why would fear make sense? And let's look at some of those terms there. Who is God? David is rehearsing. First of all, he's my light. And right away, think of what light is in the face of darkness, okay? This is the opposite of death so often in Scripture. All that is living and vibrant flows from the Lord, and God is life. He is light. He is love, all these things. So in the midst of hopelessness, Lord, you are the radiating source of any hope I could have. That's who you are. And I don't know if you guys suffer from fear of the dark. Kids, maybe you guys are afraid of the dark. And isn't it so nice when you finally get light in the midst of that? That's who God is in the midst of our trials. I remember a time, I may have shared this with you before, I don't remember. I was in college and loving the beautiful autumn around me and went for a hike in woods I thought I was familiar with. Not so familiar as I thought. Was not calculating also how quickly the sun was going down now that it was the fall. And I am now so lost, I'm not even on a trail. Right? I thought I knew where I was. And if I headed through the woods, the shortcut over this one hill, I'd be where I thought I was not. And now it's getting dark. And now it starts raining. It was just ridiculous. And I can't see. I'm not on a trail. I'm blindly walking through the woods. At one point, I am absolutely wrapped in thorns, too. I'm, caught in them. It was a cartoon kind of walk through the woods. And I will never forget the sensation where I finally crest this hill and there is this lone light in the distance. And just this joy, I don't know where it was coming from. I had no idea where I was. Didn't matter. I at least had light. And when I came out of the woods, I was like, I knew where I was. And I was on the opposite side of the county as far as I was concerned from where I thought I was coming out. And that light redirected me. And in the midst of hopelessness was exactly what I needed. Remember that picture. That's who God is. What sense would it have made to be like, light, and turn around and run the opposite way, right? That's who he is in the worst of trials. That's who he was when Peter was walking on the water and looked away from the light and looked at the waves, and now the waves were out of perspective. But even when he wasn't looking at the light, Christ reaches out and saves him. He doesn't let us go, even when we are not responding well. But how much more enjoyable would that walk on the water have been? If Peter had just been, check this out, guys. You didn't get out of the boat. Look at me. This is so much fun. Christ has me in the palm of his hand. I'm not going to fall. But he didn't have that experience because he looked away. So don't hear me say that unless you look properly, God will not help you in your trials. That's the opposite. But how much more hope and even joy in the midst of trials can we have when we run to our light in the midst of darkness? Then he says that he is his salvation, the God of his salvation. And I don't think it's going to come as any kind of bolt of lightning or mind-blowing experience for you to hear, like, guess what, guys? God is your salvation. What? But it's so common, it's the kind of thing we can just, again, let it run off our backs. But think about what that means, that David's God, our God, is the God of our salvation. What are we saved from? We're saved from God, right? We're not saved from the devil. God does protect us from him, but God didn't have to buy us back from Satan, as some of them commonly taught. God was the one who rightly pronounced our death sentence because we deserved it. And God took that upon himself so you wouldn't have to bear it. He saved you from him. It's one of the most beautiful and just incredible foolishness of the gospel kind of moments. We're saved from God by God. So if God has saved us from himself, and who is God, the mightiest being in the universe, the all-powerful being who's perfectly just, who will not permit sin to go unpunished, who will not let any of his enemies have any victory over him, that being saved you from him. So what sense does it make to be afraid, as though all will be lost in the midst of our tragedies, when the greatest thing you ever faced has been solved for you by him? So instead we should say, well, okay, if that's what you've done for me, then I stand right there with Paul and say, if God is for me, who could be against me? And then David said, he is the stronghold of my life. I don't know if good medieval castles come to mind that you have looked at. I've always been a fan of such architecture. And these places where you just wonder how they did it, where you have these incredible fortresses built in the midst of these outcrops of rock, these cliffs. You wonder, how did they even get the stone up there to do this? But those pictures of, like, how would you ever assail something like that without the modern weapons we have today? And you're raised up above where the enemy is, and you're protected by walls so they can't get to you. And David said, that's who my God is for me. In the midst of my worst tragedies, that's who he is. That God protects me. And so it's very important for us to remember in the midst of this, when we run rightly to a psalm like this, in the midst of our tragedies, you aren't facing David's foes. Okay? And God hasn't made the promises to you that he made to David. God made promises to David to protect him from earthly enemies. And so, if we're going to run to God as our stronghold, we need to remember, well, then what can I rely on him to protect me from so I'm not trusting in promises that aren't meant for me? If you recall, in the Old Testament, when Israel was set up in the Promised Land, God's kingdom was physical, right? It had physical boundaries. You could actually have 1 foot in God's kingdom and 1 foot outside of it, right? And the enemies were physical people that God told Israel to wipe out, that God promised Israel, I'll protect you from them if you obey me. Well, today God's kingdom is spiritual. We know this. We don't always act on it, but we know this. God said your battle's not against flesh and blood, but against principalities in the heavenly realms. So God has not promised you protection from people who might hurt you. That's a reality we all face. And in fact, as Christians, you should expect, the New Testament says, persecution, because you bear the name of Christ. And the brokenness of this world is also something that God has not promised to shield us from. We get sick and we die. And God has not said, but for those who trust in me, I will shield them from physical death and pain. That is not true. So what has he promised to protect you from? If he is the stronghold of your life, what can you count on? What he's promised you is this. Such difficulties we face, the mistreatment of others. And I don't mean minor stuff. Many of you I know have faced severe mistreatment at the hands of others. Some at the hands of others who would be believers or call themselves such. Some of you have faced incredible suffering from the brokenness of this world, whether it's health-related or just one trial after another. God isn't breaking promises to you by allowing you to go through that. But he has promised you they will not prevail over you. They will not be able to take away your hope. They will not cause you to turn away from God and lose your salvation. They will not cause God to turn away from you. They will not somehow take away your future that is guaranteed to you. Future in heaven with the Father, with the saints, where no tears will ever be shed again. Those things cannot rob you of what is most important to you. And while it might not feel that way in the midst of trial, that is a far, far greater promise than no temporary suffering. Sometimes when you feel like you're drowning in the waves, it feels like, no, what I need right now is a temporary relief from this. Future, who knows when that's coming? That can be very common for us to suffer from. That's why it's so important when you're not in the midst of suffering to be reminding yourself of these things so they are quickly at hand. Because often when the suffering seems overwhelming, they're hard to remember. But God is faithful, and I know many of you can attest to times when it looked like there was no hope, that out of nowhere in comes truths that God's Spirit brings to mind that bring to you that wonderful phrase from Philippians, the peace of God that transcends our understanding. And in the midst of waves that you were going to look like you were going to drown in, here you are being upheld by the Lord. He is faithful to do that for us when we aren't looking for it. But how much more joy often can we experience? How much more hope, or on the flip side, how much less hopelessness do we suffer from when we run right to the God who's our stronghold and remember what he has promised? Because the devil will tell you what? He doesn't love you. You wouldn't be suffering like this if he loved you. Maybe if you hadn't sinned so much, you wouldn't be going through this trial. Maybe if you get your life together, this trial will end. And then you're just reminded of how little you can do to change some of these sinful behaviors, and you think, God hates me, he does not love me. And what this psalm is telling you is don't believe that. No trial you go through and no poor response to your trial that you put forth can take away God's love from you. And trials are not a sign of his lack of love. Though the world, the flesh, and the devil will tell you it is. Those are powerful voices. Remember, they are not a sign of God's lack of love. They are a sign of him doing what enables us to trust him more, though it doesn't feel like it at the time. The well-meaning Christians will come by and catch, hey, he only does what's best for you, keep it up. When that's the thanks, that's the last thing I wanted to hear right now. And often, the love that you do need from them in those times is not given to you, and so you feel less helped. Please don't be that person when someone else is suffering. Be the person who says, I'm sorry, and who gives a hug and an ear And maybe when they're a little bit more ready, remind them. God doesn't do anything that is not for his purposes. This did not take him by surprise. It's not an accident, not a mistake. There is purpose for this. And what happened to Paul when he said, Lord, take away this suffering from me, asking God repeatedly? God said, I'm not going to. What was Paul's response? Okay. Then God is going to use this suffering in my life to make his power known to me, which I feel more when I'm weak. What does he say? God's power is made perfect in weakness. No, none of us wants to go through that. And please don't be so arrogant as to ask God to send you trials. Please. Ask him that no matter what comes your way, that he treats you mercifully. And that should trial come your way, you can run right to the stronghold, the God who is your salvation and light in the midst of darkness, instead of collapsing in fear. So rehearsing who God is in the first three verses, he's my light, he's my God of my salvation, he's my stronghold, then helps David begin to put things in perspective here with verses 4 through 6. He's like, here's the one thing I want in the midst of all that I'm facing. My God, who's my stronghold, I want to dwell with him. And then, what does he say? I want to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. I want to be in his temple and inquire after him. Verse 5, for what's he do? What does God promise? He will hide me in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. That's who God is and what he does. So the trials are immediately being put in perspective because where David went. And so often, our trials spin out of control. And they're real, but they become unreal in their size, eclipsing our God who is our light. And so we look around and only see darkness. But it's because the light that was in front of us, we turned around and went the other way. Our light did not go away. God does not hide himself. God hides us in him, David says. But when we're not looking for it, we don't feel it. And it's not real, depending on how you feel. Isn't that a blessing? That God doesn't love us depending on how we feel he loves us? What a blessing that is. And God is not so sovereign as only as we estimate his sovereignty. Isn't that a blessing? Because he'd be really weak if his sovereignty was only as accurate as we estimated it. But look what this does. Look at verse 6. David has been so oriented around who God is and what he does, that in the midst of trial, remember, life-threatening trial. This is not a moment of drama in David's life. This is real. What does David say in verse 6? And now my head will be lifted above my enemies all around me. I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. David is able to joyfully worship the Lord in the midst of life-threatening trial. I mean, no, it's unjust. I'll say later in the psalm, false witnesses have risen up against me. People are truly mistreating David to the point that he may be murdered. And he's able to joyfully worship. Do not, okay, here's one of those eyes up here moments. Do not misunderstand the point of this psalm as in, go be like David. Okay? If I'm sounding patronizing to you right now like you're a bunch of little kids, I kind of am. Because that's what we do. We just, okay, give me the formula to go follow, and I'll go try to be like this guy. You have missed the point. What the psalm needs to show us is that God is your God. The God offering this to David didn't just offer it to him. He's promised it to you. So yes, David's a wonderful model here, but this psalm has given us a whole lot more. That God of our salvation is your God. He is your light. He is your salvation. He is your stronghold, whether you feel it or not. So let's rest in that. Not just, oh, I've got to find a way to be like David. We all should be like David, but that is not the point. Rest in David's God because he's yours too. David is not resting in God because he found a way to kind of mind over matter himself out of a tough spot. Okay? David's not choosing the power of positive thinking against those who are trying to murder him. I don't think that ever works. In the face of those who are trying to take his life, David goes to God's promises. Resting on those promises enables him to worship in times of severe trial and mistreatment and adversity. So after David has run to God and rehearsed who he is and what he's done, putting those problems in perspective, what does David do now? He begs for deliverance. And I don't know if you, when you're reading these verses, if they took you by surprise at all, but as I was prepping the sermon this week, I kept coming back to, I'm a little afraid, I'll be honest with you, to approach God the way David does. Obviously, David's doing it sinlessly. This is scripture. This is a model prayer for you to utter to God, word for word. But listen to David. I mean, talk about approaching the throne of grace with confidence. Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud. Be gracious to me and answer me. That's incredible. And I don't think, I'll admit to you, I don't approach God with that level of confidence, and that's wrong of me. That I should approach God that way. David is not being an impatient brat here. David is showing us what confidence in God's promises enables us to do. And I need to grow. I need to grow my confidence in God's promises. Because when he's asking for deliverance, he's doing so full of hope, even though you can be full of hope and cry out in real agony. And evangelicals don't do that well at all. You either put a fake smile on and pretend everything's fine, or you go off the rails and accuse God of mistreating you. Those are kind of the two. But saying, God does nothing to me that's not just. God does nothing to me that is not full of love. And right now, I hate the circumstances I'm in. And they're so painful, I'm losing hope. So I'm running to my God, and I'm going to tell him that and beg him to deliver me from this because it's painful. And I'm worried it's going to take my life. This is truly, I don't want to say it's a blank check, but it's a check made out for everything you need right here. You can take this check to God and address him this way. God, it hurts. Please make it stop. And I know I can ask this of you because I don't ask based on my earning a place in your throne room. I know you can't turn Christ away. And because I'm taped to him, I have all the access Christ has. I can march in here and not say you owe me, but I can beg you to deliver me. And I beg all of us to beg God to help us grow in this kind of approach to him in times of trial. What David's doing here is a very important exercise for us to go through. Because a lot of what he's asking God to do, he actually knows God can't deny it. So what is he asking God to do? Don't hide your face from me. He knows God can't do that. He's the God of his salvation. How could the God of his salvation hide his face from him? He said, don't turn me away in anger. He knows God can't be angry with him. He knows God has promised to save him. He's the God of his salvation. How could the God of his salvation turn away in anger? He can't do that. He says, do not forsake me. No God of anyone's salvation can forsake them. David knows this. So why waste the time asking for it if he knows it? There's a couple reasons. First, and this is something that many of us who call ourselves Calvinists or Reformed or whatever else have really struggled with. We do a good job often. God is sovereign. Everything happens according to his plan. He's almighty. Why exactly do I pray again then? His plan's already in place. He's already sovereign. What's the point? The Bible never goes there, right? What's the harshest predestination chapter in the Bible? Romans 9, right? It's caused many of us to stay up late or skip it. What's the most impassioned plea to God to save the lost, in my opinion, in the entire Bible? Romans 10 follows right on the heels of, here's how sovereign God is. And Paul says, then Lord, send forth preachers so people can be saved. No conflict for Paul. Shouldn't be a conflict for us either, because you know what God does, and this is wonderfully mind-boggling. Stand back and worship God for this. Don't be perplexed over it. God's plan includes accomplishing things via our prayers. So it is right for us to say, I came to faith at such and such age because my mom prayed for years that I would.
Excuse me, you came to faith because you were elect.
Both are true. God sovereignly planned that your mother would pray, and he used that to bring you to faith. As the Lord commands us, pray, pray, pray throughout the scriptures. Don't let God's sovereignty be a hindrance to your prayer. It should be all the more of an encouragement. There's nothing I'm asking God that he can't do unless I'm asking him to not be God anymore. Hopefully you're not praying those things. You're asking God who's all-powerful to do these things and to work through your prayers to accomplish those things. That's what he loves to do. And that's the kind of God he is. So in the midst of these trials, go to him because he's sovereign and almighty. And he will use your prayers to accomplish things. I can't say he'll always give you what you want. But your prayer is not wasted, and it will give you what you need. And that's the other thing David's doing here. David is asking God things he knows cannot be denied. And what's it doing? It's reorienting David around these truths. It's helping him own these things. God, I know you're my light. I know you are the God of my salvation. I know you're my stronghold. So hear me. Don't turn away. And I know you can't. Don't forsake me. And if you're the God of my salvation, I know you won't. Don't be angry at me. And if you've promised to save me and promise you'll dwell with me forever, then I know you won't. It helps David own it. It helps him, if you will, put shoes on those things and walk in these truths. I know it's a cliche that sometimes we don't want to hear because friends tell us this when we're praying about something and we're not getting what we want. And we hear this. Prayer doesn't change God, it changes us. Well, prayer won't change God. It doesn't mean he won't use it in his plan. But praise God, our prayer changes us, right? Thank goodness we don't sit here in this terrible spot. And how many times, I hope you can attest to these times where you go to the Lord and you're bitter and you know you're praying with a sinful attitude sometimes, but you begin to be changed in the midst of your prayer because you are being reminded by the Spirit of who you're talking to and who he is and what his word says and that he is your God who loves you and won't forsake you. And you come out of that prayer changed. Not permanently. Need to do it again 2 minutes later often. But praise God, he uses prayer both to accomplish his will and to change us and reorient us around who he is and what he's done to put our trials and adversity in perspective. But notice what David does here. And boy, do we not do this often. In verse 11, in the midst of being of crying out for deliverance, what does David say in verse 11? Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. How often in the midst of trial do we become our own worst enemy, wreaking damage on our soul that ends up being worse than those who are mistreating us? David knows, I just don't need protection from those who are assaulting me. I need protection from me too. I need you to guide me in your way in the midst of this. Sometimes we look at this the wrong way. And I know I've had to tell some of you this. In the midst of trials that are prolonged, you start wondering, when is the Lord going to let up? When is this going to go away? And you start thinking, maybe he's doing this to teach me a lesson, and maybe if I just learn it, then this will go away. But because I'm still in this trial, apparently I'm still failing the exam. If I could just pass this and get over it, maybe the trial will go away. You can learn something in any circumstance, right? We should always be looking for the Lord to teach us in the greatest times of joy and trial. But please don't operate under the false assumption that there's a specific lesson you're failing, and if you don't learn it, God will never take this trial away. This might come as cold comfort, But what if you're going through a trial to teach the rest of us a lesson as we watch you go through it? God uses our trials in all sorts of ways. Yes, there are things to learn in the midst of your trials, and beg God for that. But don't assume that you're under his thumb because you keep failing an exam. Until you get the answers right, he won't let up. Please don't let that lie be an additional burden on you to the trial you're already under. You can always learn. And in the midst of trial, we should ask, Lord, please do teach me so that I'm glorifying you in the midst of trial. Not so I find out the secret answer I haven't discovered yet. Help me glorify you in my trials. And that's what David's begging to do. So he can be worshiping God joyfully, even in the midst of sorrow. David is not some naive optimist with some kind of Pollyanna lesson for us, okay? Come on, guys, put the happy face on. David owned his pain. God, answer me. Don't turn away. But teach me also so he can be worshiping God as we saw in verse 6. Because David has known real pain. But David has also known the sustaining of him by God in the worst trials. He knows God does this. He's experienced it before, and he's asking for it again. Because he knows he can count on God's promises. Therefore, why would he fear? And so in the last part here in verses 13 through 14, we have his exhortation to himself, but also to all who would hear his words. Wait on the Lord then. But it's not just a, all right, I'll wait. Now this is exhortation. Exuberance based on what? Well, we'll look at verse 13 says, after he's earnestly begged the Lord for deliverance, he says, I believe I will look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. And that is not him claiming a promise to eternal life there. That it would not be inappropriate. The land of the living is often used as a phrase of living a blessed life on earth. And he's saying, hold on. God's made promises to me. I know I got armies coming after me here. I do not have earthly power here to win. But if this is before David was king, he promised me I'm going to be king. Or later, he's promised me sons. My sons are going to reign on this throne. And as we see David do often, like we'll see next week in Psalm 40, David knows in the old covenant, God gives earthly blessings and rich life for obedience. And so David thanks God for delivering from his enemies, saying, you saw that I obeyed you, and you kept your promise to me to sustain my life. What David's doing here is going to promises God made him. Lord, if you promise me this is going to happen, then these armies, I can sit here and not worry one bit. You can't break a promise to me. Now, God has not promised you the same promises to David, right? He hasn't promised you rich life in the land of the living. But what has he promised you? Something better. So we copy David's model here, but with better promises. He's promised you eternal life. He's promised you eternal love, eternal hope, eternal joy in the eternal land of the living. So nothing can take that from you. And he's promised to never forsake you, to never turn away from you. And so in the midst of trial, he hasn't done that. So you can rely on those promises and say, Lord, then I will trust you that you will do what is best for me. You promised you will. And you promised me I can have joy in the midst of trial. I'm going to beg you for that, and I'm going to wait for it. Waiting on the Lord here is not just a backhand saying, hey, quit complaining, be patient. It's an exhortation saying, wait a minute. Oh, we can calm down. We can realize that though this trial hurts, it can't take away what is ultimate. And my greatest problems have been solved. My eternal destiny is sure. Then I can wait and trust and rest in the Lord and not convince myself that I have to save myself somehow, which I can't even do. The trials David's facing, he cannot solve. They're real. But even though he can't solve them, he knows he can rest in a God who can. In a God who's made promises that cannot be broken. And God keeps them because he's promised, not because you have earned it. Christ earned it for you. Therefore, there is no possibility those promises to you can be broken. We have a beautiful picture of what this kind of waiting on the Lord looks like at the end of Habakkuk. If you recall, Habakkuk looks at all the injustice in Israel and says, hey, God, you're going to get off your chair and do something about this? I thought you opposed injustice. What are you doing? And God's answer, if you recall, Maybe I'm an awful person. It always makes me chuckle. God's answer is like, oh, don't worry, I'm going to do something. I'm going to send the Babylonians in to kill all of you. He's like, oh, those godless people who are worse than us. Explain to me how you're able to do that and be just. Habakkuk is not having a good day, okay? And then God says, Habakkuk, I'm gonna give you a reminder of my stats, as it were. Here's my baseball card. See what I've done in my career? Remember who I am? And Habakkuk says this. I heard, and my heart pounded, my lips quivered at the sound. Decay crept into my bones, and my legs trembled. Yet, I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come on the nation invading us. Though the fig tree does not bud and there are no grapes on the vine, though the olive crop fails, and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen, and no cattle in the stall, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in the God of my salvation. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to tread on the heights. The same phrase that the God of my salvation is what he goes to. He knows destruction is coming. God promised it. Everything Habakkuk sees around him will be destroyed. Those he loves will be killed. He knows that's coming, and yet he could say that. Not because Habakkuk is a great, strong guy. Habakkuk was, we saw in the book, not a good guy. But a proper perspective on God's promises can enable us to say that. And he goes from what? A guy with trembling legs in whose bones has crept decay to being what? Like a deer on the mountains. Nothing more sure-footed. They leap. You think, how can they remain standing there and not fall? Because it's a picture of being elevated on the heights by God, above the things that would take away your hope, sustaining you so that nothing takes away your hope. So no matter what God has in store for us, this kind of joy is there for us. It's not just for the strong. God sustains us in these moments. Habakkuk was not strong. But being reoriented around who God is and what God does enabled that kind of faith to emerge. And so we beg God in adversity, Lord, sustain me. Help me remember you're my light and my strength. Enable me to worship you joyfully in this time and make your promises clear to me so I can rest in you. And he will not forsake any of you in your trials because the Son was forsaken in your place once and for all time. Therefore, you may and can and will have a hope that lasts forever.